Get your advanced PhD in WOW from Floor and Decor. If you're a pro, you're already an expert in tile, wood, and stone. And with Floor and Decor's job site delivery, their free design services, and pro rewards that actually reward you, your business is set to grow from one client to the next. Floor and Decor isn't just a couple of aisles. It's an entire store designed to help your business boom. It's Floor and Decor.
At Delta, we know Mike in 8C prefers reality TV to reality. So we provide more than 1,000 hours of in-flight entertainment. On the next flight, 8C is Mandy, a foodie. So we offer all types of food options. Because at Delta, everyone flies their own way. Delta, keep climbing.
Brett McKay here, and welcome to another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. When people think of the plays of Shakespeare, they tend to think of his comedies and tragedies that spotlight interpersonal dynamics like love and jealousy, pretense and reality. But my guests would say that many of Shakespeare's plays, especially his sometimes overlooked histories, are also unmatchable in revealing the dynamics of power. Elliot Cohen is a military historian, political scientist, professor of international studies, and former State Department counselor, as well as the author of The Hollow Crown: Shakespeare and How Leaders Rise, Rule, and Fall. Today on the show, Elliot takes us through what Shakespeare's plays can teach us about navigating the three-part arc of power: acquiring power, exercising power, and losing power. Along the way, we discuss how these lessons in leadership played out in the lives of real-life historical figures as well. After the show's over, check out our show notes at aom.is/Shakespeare. All right, Elliot Cohen, welcome to the show.
It's good to be with you, Brett. Thanks for having me.
So you got a new book out called The Hollow Crown: Shakespeare on How Leaders Rise, Rule, and Fall. Tell us about your background, and how did your background lead you to writing a book about what Shakespeare can teach us about power?
So it's a little bit unusual. I'm not a literature professor or anything like that. I've spent a career in the university world, but also in government. I'm mainly a military historian, somebody who writes a lot about national security policy, but I've also served in government in the Defense Department during the George H.W. Bush administration, and then in the Department of State in the George W. Bush administration as the counselor. So I was the senior advisor to Secretary Rice and to the rest of the department. And I've done various things in the intelligence community as well. So I'm coming at it from a very different sort of perspective. And the reason why I decided to write the book is I'd always liked Shakespeare. But the moment that it occurred to me that there was something to do with this was going to see a play of Shakespeare's that's relatively rarely put on, Henry VIII. And in Henry VIII, one of the things that happens is the king's chancellor, Cardinal Wolsey, who's been very powerful and quite arrogant, is suddenly deposed. And if you and your listeners will bear with me, I'll just read what he says in a soliloquy, a speech to the audience, as after he learns out that he's suddenly been stripped of all his titles. He says, "Farewell, a long farewell to all my greatness. This is the state of man. Today he puts forth the tender leaves of hopes, tomorrow blossoms, and bears his blushing honors thick upon him. The third day comes a frost, a killing frost. And when he thinks, good easy man, full surely his greatness is ripening, nips his root, and then he falls as I do. I have ventured like little wanton boys that swim on bladders this many summers in a sea of glory, but far beyond my depth. My high-blown pride at length broke under me, and now has left me, weary and old with service, to the mercy of a rude stream that must forever hide me." And it was a very good performance. And I looked at that speech, and I thought to myself, you know, I know that guy. As somebody who's been in Washington now for over a generation, for over 35 years, I've seen people who've been swimming on a sea of glory, and then all of a sudden their pride burst beneath them and they sink. So it prompted me to begin talking with some of my students at Johns Hopkins, who are all graduate students and are going off to careers in government and things like that, about some Shakespearean speeches. And that turned into a course, and that made me in turn realize that there was a different kind of book about Shakespeare to be written, one that really talks about what he has to tell us about leadership.
What I love about this book is you show how this idea of Shakespeare exploring power goes beyond just politics. It's applicable to business. I'm sure there's lots of executives who can be like that guy giving the soliloquy. Like, I was riding high and then suddenly, you know, the wheel of fortune has turned and now I'm out of a job. Or it could be like a young person who seems like they've got everything going for them, and then suddenly their fortunes shift. And what do you do with that? How do you deal with that?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I'll tell you another thing that motivated me to write the book was for a number of years, I was the dean of my division of Johns Hopkins, the School of Advanced International Studies. And so much of that was applicable, of what's in Shakespeare was applicable to my own experience. And one of the things that Shakespeare has to teach us is thinking about human organizations as courts. And if you think about it, you know, you don't have to have princes and kings and queens, but in most organizations are pretty hierarchical. And at the top, there is a king or a queen. There may be a crown prince, you know, who's the designated successor. There's certainly a whole bunch of courtiers out there. There's often a court jester or two. And what Shakespeare really knew and understood very, very well was the politics of courts. And for sure, you know, when I was at a dean, I had my own kind of, you know, mini court. President of the university had a much bigger court. And it affected human relationships. So it's true of business. It's true of universities. It's true of nonprofits. You know, there are things that go well beyond people in robes who are wearing crowns on their head.
Yeah, and I love that idea that seeing the world through the world of the court, right? There's courts everywhere. It's not just in a king. It can happen in a corporation. It can happen in a nonprofit. It can even happen in a restaurant. And so what I love about this book is you highlight how we gain influence, what are the problems of managing our influence, and what happens whenever our influence starts to wane. And you also highlight there's a lot of famous leaders from world history who studied Shakespeare to get insights about how to gain power, how to wield it, and how to manage with people trying to overthrow you. What were some of these leaders that you found?
So I think the one who's would be most interesting to an American audience, of course, would be Abraham Lincoln. Lincoln adored Shakespeare. He believed it was better to read it than see it, although he actually did attend a number of plays. One of the things I talk about in the book is he invited a very famous actor who was actually, among other things, a brother of the assassin who eventually killed him, to kind of quiz him about one of his performances. But the thing that's chilling, I think, is he particularly liked the play Macbeth. And if I could read just another short excerpt.
That'd be great.
He's coming back from a visit to Richmond after the fall of Richmond to the Army of the Potomac. And he's on a steamer and he's coming back to Washington and he's sort of in a reflective mood. And he, of course, has his staff around him and some of his subordinates. And he says, you know, have you read Macbeth? Macbeth is wonderful. And he recites from memory one of his favorite passages. This is after the king, Duncan, has been killed by Macbeth. And it's actually Macbeth himself saying this. Better be with the dead, whom we to gain our peace have sent to peace, than on the torture of the mind to lie in restless ecstasy. Duncan is in his grave. After life's fitful fever, he sleeps well. Treason has done his worst. Nor steel, nor poison, malice domestic, foreign levy, nothing can touch him further. Now, the thing that's chilling about that, of course, is that only 5 days later, treason did its worst, and Lincoln was assassinated. It's a very interesting passage because I think it reveals some of the dark side of Lincoln, or the sort of more melancholy side. You know, it's interesting that line that better be with the dead whom we to gain our peace have sent to peace. And I suspect that he spent time thinking about the tremendous human cost of the Civil War. Another great Shakespearean was Winston Churchill. It's interesting. There's a lot of his letters which have spontaneous quotes, sometimes from rather obscure plays. There's one from World War I where he's quoting Henry VI, which is a play that most people don't know at all in three parts. There's a great story that the great actor Richard Burton used to tell. So after World War II, he's playing Hamlet, And he gets word, this is shortly after the war, that the old man is going to be in the audience. Well, when you say the old man in England in 1949, there's only one old man, and it was Churchill. So there was Churchill in the front row. And Burton describes his horror when he hears this kind of rumbling, and he realizes that Churchill is reciting the speeches even as he's giving them. And he describes trying to speed it up and try to slow it down to shake him off. And he can't shake him off. And so he's thoroughly traumatized by this. The story has a more or less happy ending. He's, you know, quite shaken. At the intermission, he goes back to his dressing room. There's a knock at the door. And he opens the door. And there's Winston Churchill, who looks at him and says, "My Lord Hamlet, may I have use of your washroom?" Which is a great story. Now, the one thing, though, to be aware of is it wasn't just the good guys who liked Shakespeare. The Nazis liked Shakespeare. And it wasn't just because of Merchant of Venice, which is in many ways an anti-Semitic play, although it's much more than that. There were other plays that really appealed to them. And I think, you know, we have to wrestle with that. And I think it's the reason why that could be the case is because Shakespeare is, as you know, some of the people who've commented on him have said, a mirror to human nature. You know, he's giving us all of human nature. He's not giving us a political point of view. He's not telling us what to do. He's showing us people as they really are. And that, I think, is really his genius. And there, you know, there are aspects of human nature which are pretty ugly and appeal to really ugly people as well.
Which plays of Shakespeare explore the idea of power the most? I'm sure everyone's read Romeo and Juliet or Midsummer's Night Dream when they were in high school. Those plays maybe a little bit talk about power, but what are the ones that you focus on in this book?
So there are many more. I do a lot with the histories. There's really 8 plays, believe it or not, that carry you through there. So there's Richard II, which is about a brilliant but very weak king who gets overthrown by Henry Bolingbroke, who becomes Henry IV. So then you have 2 Henry IV plays, Henry IV Part 1 and Part 2. Henry IV's son is Prince Hal, who's a brilliant leader, although I tend to think he's extremely unscrupulous and problematic. So there's a play called Henry V. And then there are 3 plays called Henry VI, Henry VI Part 1, 2, and 3. And Henry VI is Henry V's son, but he's actually a very weak king. So a lot of that is about infighting among courtiers. And then finally, there's Richard III. And Richard III is the ultimate bad guy. He's the evil king, but he's an absolutely fascinating character, which is troubling in many ways. And so you have those 8 plays. I would say those are really at the core, but there are others. There's a set of Roman plays, I think Julius Caesar, Coriolanus, which is not put on very much, but which I think is very powerful, about a Roman general who is a terrific general. He wants to be consul, sort of the top job in Rome, and he blows it because he doesn't know how to deal with the people. And he becomes a traitor. That's a terrific play. There's Antony and Cleopatra. So you have the Roman plays. And then there are some of the great tragedies. And above all, I think Macbeth. Because Macbeth is a story of a warrior who is not necessarily innately a bad guy, unlike somebody like Richard III, but who is seduced by power and ends up committing one murder, hopes he can get away with just committing one murder. But of course, he really can't.
All right, so what you do in this book is you take readers through a 3-part arc of power: acquiring power, exercising power, and losing power. So let's talk about acquiring power, how we get power in the first place. And in Shakespeare's world, you argue there are 3 ways that a king or a leader can acquire power. It's through inheritance, through their own skill and cunning, or through seizure, or there's a coup d'etat or something like that. Let's talk about inheriting power. In which plays does Shakespeare explore the dynamics of inheriting power?
I think for the question of inheritance is, in some ways, the best are the 2 Henry IV plays, because the 2 Henry IV plays are only partly about Henry IV. They're really much more about Prince Hal, who is a continual disappointment to his father, although he will turn out to be a greater leader, who is hanging around with Falstaff, who's this wonderful comic creation, but who is somebody who has no illusions about human nature and is a coward and a drunkard. And Prince Hal is kind of living in the rough side of town, what's pretty clearly a brothel. And he is actually, you know, at first you might think he's just kind of dissolute. Actually, what he's doing is he's learning how to be a leader, because he unlike his father, he learns how to deal with normal people, people who are not like himself, consumed with this lust for glory. Now, he also has to, you know, achieve success on the battlefield, and he does. Particularly, he ends up killing Hotspur, Harry Hotspur, who's his leader of the kind of rebellion against his father. And Hotspur is a very attractive figure. And I think the point of all that, that Shakespeare shows us, is even if you can inherit power legitimately, I mean, Henry V is the son of Henry IV. And, you know, the way royal succession worked in England at that time is the oldest son becomes the king. What Prince Hal realizes is he has to earn it. And I think that's a big insight. I think a lot of people don't understand that once you get to a position of power, that's not where the story ends. You have to be continually earning it. And Hal is actually able to do that. Other people are not. Somebody who inherits power but doesn't understand that he has to continually win it, as it were, is Richard II, who Henry IV has killed. Richard II is somebody who's intoxicated with the office. You know, if there were corner offices back then, he'd want one. You know, he'd want a limo and all the trappings of power, but he doesn't know how to use it. And for sure, he doesn't understand that he has to continually win it. And he pays the ultimate price for it.
And you talk about how we see the inheritance of power in our own day. This plays out in politics, right? When a president, you know, they often choose their successor. They're going to groom a successor, or they have a successor in mind. In the business world, sometimes a CEO, once they know they're going to retire, you know, they start grooming their successor and trying to figure out who's going to replace them. But often, even when they have a plan for succession, it doesn't work out the way they planned.
Yeah, and you know, the classic example is Jack Welch, famous head of GE, who built it into a huge corporation, very successful, widely regarded as one of the best managers of all time, who prided himself on grooming talent. And he goes through this elaborate process, and he picks Jeffrey Immelt to be the head of GE. And in very short order, Immelt blows up GE. Now, people argue, was it his fault or not? But the point is, you know, leaders often think that they can control the future, that they can control what's going to happen once they've stepped down. That's also the story of King Lear, by the way. He thinks he's going to have all the perks of power, and he'll still exercise control even after he's handed over his kingdom to his two evil daughters. And you know what? You can't. And I think a lot of people wrestle with that. I mean, one of the problems with picking a successor is you have to set your own ego aside and realize, well, maybe I need somebody who's different than myself. You know, one of Henry IV's problems, and he doesn't really get along with his son just about till he dies, is he can't understand that the ways in which Henry V, Prince Hal, is different from him could actually make him a more effective king. And, you know, he's just disappointed that Prince Hal isn't more like his old man. And that's, you know, as somebody who's helped raise four kids, I know that's always a bad idea.
This idea of inheriting power and how it can go wrong made me think about the relationship between Theodore Roosevelt and Taft.
Oh, that is a great case.
Yeah. So, you know, Roosevelt, he was basically grooming Taft to be his successor. And the thing about Taft was he really didn't want to be president. Like, he had high ambitions, but he wasn't like Roosevelt, who loved to be out making decisions and being out with people and just taking action. Taft was a little more cerebral. He wanted to be a Supreme Court justice. That's where he thought he'd be most suited.
Right.
But he kind of got on this conveyor belt and felt this pressure. Well, I got to do this because Roosevelt wants me to do it. My wife wants me to be president. And so he becomes president. And Theodore Roosevelt is just basically like, man, Taft is doing a terrible job. And basically turned against him, and it hurt their friendship.
Oh, he essentially runs against him for president. No, I think it's a great case because, you know, what TR is looking for, and I think this frequently happens with people pick their successors, subconsciously or not, looking for somebody who's simply going to do what the old, you know, sort of follow the guidelines that the old man set out for him, rather than really carve out his own path in his own way. And they're always disappointed. And the other thing about Taft was a very able subordinate for TR. And, you know, there are certain kinds of people in this world who are excellent number twos, but you never want them to be number ones. And I think that's really what happened to TR and to Taft. And it was a tragedy in many ways. I mean, they sort of reconciled a bit at the end, but it was really unfortunate, and it wasn't fair to Taft, and I say that as an admirer of TR. It wasn't fair to have picked him, and then it wasn't really fair to have turned on him either. It also speaks, again, to how hard it is for powerful people to walk away from power.
Yeah. So let's talk about what Shakespeare can teach us about acquiring power through skill. Any plays or a character from Shakespeare's plays that really highlights how through cunning and their own virtue or excellence or skill, you can acquire power?
Well, you know, we've been dwelling a lot on the Henry IV plays, but I would talk about Richard II, actually, the Richard II play and the figure of Henry Bolingbroke, who becomes Henry IV, who is very cunning in the way that he pushes Richard aside. Now, there's I've had very lively debates with critics about, you know, did Bolingbroke always want to be king, or is it just that he was treated unjustly by Richard II, who confiscates his father's estates, John of Gaunt? But I think what he does is he's very subtle. He's very restrained in his use of force. Henry Bolingbroke, like Henry IV that he becomes, knows when to be quiet. He knows when to be decisive. One of my favorite lines of his is, "If these be necessities, let us meet them like necessities," which is not a bad motto if you're a leader in difficult times. But he's restrained. He does, unlike somebody like Richard III, he doesn't kill for the joy of killing people. He's not innately cruel. Unlike Macbeth, he doesn't deceive himself into thinking, you know, I can kill somebody and then I'll be king. He is very concerned about legitimacy, and, you know, his legitimacy is always to some extent in question. And he's cunning. And it's, you know, there are other people who are like that. I mean, it's a dimension of Lincoln, for example, that people, I think, often overlook. His law partner, Willie Herndon, once said that any man who took Abraham Lincoln for a simple man usually found himself lying on his back in a ditch. You know, there was a lot of subtlety and, you know, a certain degree of ruthlessness. I mean, I think that's part of Shakespeare's measure there too, is you don't acquire power simply by being a nice person.
Yeah, what you have to do is you have to appear nice, right? You have to cloak your ambition and your desire for power through, I'm a nice guy, I'm trying to do a good cause. I mean, maybe you are doing good, right, in the process, but the ultimate aim is to acquire power.
Right, right. And again, another Willie Herndon quote, he said that Abraham Lincoln's ambition was a little machine that never stopped ticking. You know, the kinds of people, and I think Shakespeare's very alive to this. In a certain way, it comes out best in the Roman plays. You know, all of us have some level of ambition in some case. But you know, people who really aspire to top positions, and again, whether it's a CEO or president of a university or president of the United States, that level of ambition makes you very, very different than most normal people. And, you know, the rest of us have to understand that's what those people are like. They are just different than you and me. And they, in turn, have to understand the people whose support they are trying to get. And the ones who succeed are, you know, the ones who manage to do that.
And then you also talk about one thing that Shakespeare touches on, and you see this in the lives of great leaders. You might be skilled in one domain, say the military. You see this a lot for leaders who did well in the military, and they say, "Well, I'm a great general. I could be a great president now." And they try their hand at another domain, and they just fumble. They do terrible. Anything Shakespeare can teach us about that?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the play to look at is Coriolanus, which I mentioned earlier about this Roman general who becomes a traitor, who is a brilliant military leader. And he's a great speaker. I mean, his speeches are terrific. They're filled with invective. But he has no self-discipline, though, when it comes to talking to the people. And he has no control over his temper. And there comes a moment where he's just won this smashing victory. And even though the people don't really like him because he's kind of sarcastic and rude and rough and contemptuous, and the tribunes, who are sort of the representatives of the people, are fearful that he really wants to be a tyrant, they have to go along with this until the moment comes when, in order for Coriolanus to be elected a consul, he has to show his wounds, take off his toga, and show all of his scars. And he just detonates. You know, he said, I'd rather anything than show you my scars, you know, because in his view, this would be pandering to the vulgar curiosity of people who've never been in battle. And it would make it look as if he got those wounds, not for his own honor or glory or sense of duty, but in order to kind of pander to the people and get power. Parenthetically, by the way, I'll just tell you, this is one of the joys of teaching Shakespeare, where I did at the School of Advanced International Studies, a graduate school of international relations. I had a number of students in my class who were in their early 30s, who had served in places like Iraq and Afghanistan and Libya. And I said to them, don't feel obliged to answer this, but when you came back, did anybody ask to see your wounds? By which I meant not physical wounds, but, you know, kind of probe their psyches. And boy, they all detonated. You know, they felt exactly the same emotion that Coriolanus did. Now, they had kept it under better control, I dare say. But it's a very, very human reaction. And I, you know, what makes Coriolanus, his fatal flaw is not that he has that kind of instinctive resistance to exposing himself to people, but that he doesn't know how to control it. Either to say, look, I won't be consul, you know, I'm not going to stoop that low, or kind of grit his teeth and put up with it. And that's really his fatal flaw.
We're going to take a quick break for a word from our sponsors. It's wedding season, and while weddings are all about the bride and groom, they're also a chance for you to look your best. With a fully custom suit from Indochino, you'll walk into wedding season looking like $1 million, even though suits start at just $499. It's easier than ever to be the best dressed with Indochino. Order your custom suits now and they'll be ready for wedding season. The process of customizing a suit on Indochino, very easy to do. It's also a lot of fun. I've talked about my navy blue suit I've gotten from Indochino. First off, you can decide how the jacket is, how you want the pockets on the jacket to be, how you want the lapels, the vent on the back, the lining on the pants. You can decide you want pleats or no pleats. I went no pleats on my pants on this one. And then you do the measuring process. You'll need someone to help you, but they have this very easy to follow guide. Send that all in a few weeks, you have a custom made-to-measure suit sent directly to your door, and you're going to pay about the same price for a suit that you'd pay for an off-the-rack suit at a department store. Look your best this wedding season at the table or on the dance floor when you wear Indochino. Go to Indochino.com today and use code MANLINESS to get 10% off any purchase of $399 or more. That's Indochino.com, promo code MANLINESS. Check it out today. Have you always struggled with finding time to manage your finances? At the end of a busy week, the last thing you want to do is spend time budgeting all of your expenses or tracking down customer service teams to cancel old subscriptions you no longer use. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. My favorite feature on Rocket Money is finding those unwanted subscriptions. If you're like me, you have a bunch of those things you signed up for but forgot about, streaming services, newsletters, maybe some fitness plans. You just connect your account to the app, Rocket Money finds the recurring subscription fees, and then you can easily cancel them from the app. It's a really cool service. They also have a service that can help you lower your bill. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. They'll deal with the customer service for you. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all the app's features. That's a lot of money. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/manliness. That's rocketmoney.com/manliness, rocketmoney.com/manliness. Have you ever been to an event where you just had to get the best seats? Like maybe it was a concert for your favorite band, or maybe it was an important game for your favorite team. Well, to do that, you had to set an alarm to get the tickets as soon as they went on sale. When you want the best, you have to act quickly, or someone else will get it instead. It's like if you are trying to hire for your business and you want to find the most talented people for your open roles before the competition scoops them up. So what's the best way to do that? ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast, and right now you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/manliness. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles. Immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best people fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/manliness. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/manliness, M-A-N-L-I-N-E-S-S. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. There have been a lot of amazing people as guests on this podcast, but what if you want to go deeper? If you're looking somewhere to learn from the most remarkable people, that's Masterclass. Masterclass offers over 200 classes to pick from, with new classes added every month, and they have over 180 world-class instructors, and a lot of them are former AOM podcast guests. For example, Chris Voss has a class on negotiation, Jocko Willink has a class on leadership, and Malcolm Gladwell has a class on writing. With Masterclass, you get unlimited access to intimate one-on-one classes with the world's best. Plus, every new membership comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee, so there's no risk. One class that I've really enjoyed is the one with Chris Voss on negotiation. My favorite lesson in that class was the lesson on tactical empathy, something we talked about in the podcast that we did with him a long time ago, but he goes in deeper with this. And besides just the lectures, you get exercises so you can actually put this stuff into practice. Right now, listeners will get an additional 15% off annual membership at masterclass.com/AOM. Get 15% off right now at masterclass.com/AOM. Masterclass.com/AOM. And now back to the show. So you talk about another way you can acquire power is seizing it. What do you mean by seizing power?
Well, I mean, quite literally in the case of Macbeth, it's murder. He murders King Duncan. But, again, let's not forget, there are analogies to this. I won't name the institution. This was a number of years ago. But I know one institution which was led by a not particularly effective leader. And one of his key subordinates really plotted against him and was able to convince the board to remove him and then kind of orchestrate things so that he would be put in charge of it. I know another more recent case where a somewhat similar kind of thing happens. There are coups. There are people who will try to undermine somebody in charge with the idea of replacing them either themselves or with a creature. And it's ugly, but it can succeed. And, that's also part of organizational life.
Does Shakespeare have any insights on the dangers of acquiring power through seizure or how to navigate definitely? Yeah,
absolutely. There's a famous passage when Macbeth is thinking about should he kill Duncan, and he knows it's wrong, and he knows it's doubly wrong because he's his guest. But he's thinking, maybe I could just do this, and then it'll all be over, and everything will be okay. And he does go ahead with it, even though deep down he knows that one murder will lead to another murder. And I think that's really the key to it that Shakespeare is teaching us, that if you take power that way, the chances are the original crime are not going to be the only crime you're going to have to commit. You're going to have to do other ruthless things. And the illegitimacy of your seizure of power will never go away. Even the case of Henry IV, where I would argue it's more by kind of manipulation because Richard II resigns his crown and he's pressured and so on. But it's not the same thing as simply ordering his murder. He's haunted by this for the rest of his days. And even his son, Hal, is also haunted by this. So I think that's what Shakespeare has to teach us there, that if that's how you take power, essentially through some sort of coup d'etat, it's not going to end there. It'll be with you for a long time.
Yeah, that's how you'll get removed. Live by the sword, die by the sword.
Yeah, absolutely.
So once you acquire power, You have to exercise it, because that's how you keep your power, right? If you inherit power, you actually have to exercise power so you can earn it. And then you talk about the difference between management and the art of command. What are the differences between the two, and what separates leaders who might be good managers from those who are good commanders?
So let me actually make a kind of a three-part distinction between leadership, command, and management, all of which are critical, by the way, I think. So leadership, well, I would say management. Let's start with management. Management is the art of coordinating human activity. And, you know, obviously the bigger the organization, the more complex the activity. So let's just think about organizing a picnic, you know, making sure that you have all the food ordered and you've reserved the place where you're going to do the barbecue and you've arranged for a bus to pick people up. That's the management part of it. Command, which people tend not to think as much about, is about the art of giving authoritative directions. And I mean, the military spends a lot of time thinking about how to issue commands. There are times for any organization where the top person has to say, I need you to do this. But that's actually a more complicated art than you might think. But it's like, say, you know, giving directions to the bus driver on the way to the picnic. You just need to tell him where to go and tell him in such a way that he'll get you there with a minimum of fuss. It's not about coordinating human activity. It's about giving clear guidance. Leadership is the art of getting people either to do things they would not otherwise do or getting them to do them better than they otherwise would. So to use the picnic analogy again, it's making sure everybody has a good time. It's making sure that everybody feels included. It's making sure that, you know, the baseball game that you play in the park is not a chore, but it's something that everybody's really enjoying doing and everybody's participating and feels good about it. You know, leadership has those three aspects to it. And not everybody is equally good at all three of them. You know, there are people who can be terrifically inspiring, but couldn't organize their way out of a paper bag. There are people who are great at inspiring, but they can't actually give guidance, do this, and so on.
So any characters from Shakespeare that help us see these differences?
Well, the person who's really all purpose is Henry V. Who can manage things. You know, he arranges the pretext for an unjust war in such a way that it's the French who start it, and the kind of moral difficulty associated with it falls on the English church. You know, that was an art, that was management. You see him throughout that play giving very direct orders. He knows what he wants people to do, and he knows what he wants people not to do, and he's extremely clear about those things, and effectively so. So, for example, you know, he scares the hell out of the French at this town of Harfleur. But when they surrender, he is very, very clear about, you know, I want the people in the city treated well. I don't want any looting. And that's very important. And his instructions are clear. And then he is a great leader. Now, a lot of that, I think, it's of questionable honesty. So, you know, he gives this very famous speech, which makes everybody sit up straight in their chair. You know, we few, we happy few, we band of brothers, for he today that sheds his blood with me shall be my brother, and so on. Very, very, very famous speech, and gets imitated by everybody from Winston Churchill to Volodymyr Zelensky. Now, does it represent what he really thinks? I don't really think so, because he's, you know, the night before he'd been wandering around the camp and he hears the soldiers grumbling. And he, you know, he calls them fools and peasants. But when it's on the battlefield, he's calling them my brother. And he does it in a way that convinces us, even though we've just heard him describe his soldiers in a very, very different way the night before. So he's really the all-around leader. Henry IV, his father, is a manager, but he doesn't inspire people really, certainly not in the Henry IV plays. He is very good at giving commands. It's, you know, that if these be necessities, let us treat them like necessities. You know, in, I think, plays like Julius Caesar, you see some characters who are tremendously inspiring. And, you know, Mark Antony is in this famous scene where he turns the crowd around against the people who've murdered Caesar. But he's not actually great at managing things. The guy who's great at managing things is Octavius, who will eventually become emperor, who's kind of in the background, but it turns out to be much more effective. So it's not clear that, you know, any one of these characteristics is always dominant. There are times and places where one of the three can be much more important than the others.
Exercising power often requires manipulation. And this is a big reason why people don't like to try to go for power. You know, like, oh, I don't want to do the politics. It feels dirty. Yep. It doesn't make me feel good. But Henry understood to exercise power, he needed to manipulate. So, you know, he believed one thing, but he was willing to give this stirring speech so these, you know, peasants would fight for him, even though he didn't think much of them. Any other Shakespeare characters who understood that sometimes in order to exercise power, you got to get your hands dirty and maybe manipulate things?
Yeah, I would say if you look at Julius Caesar and if you look at the plotters against Caesar, the character who actually I have the most sympathy for is Cassius. It's young Cassius has a lean and hungry look. And people probably remember that line from high school. Julius Caesar doesn't trust him. Cassius needs to get Brutus to lead the plot against Caesar. And he orchestrates it. And he knows what needs to be done. But he knows he's not an inspiring enough figure to bring other people along. For that, he needs Brutus, who is flawed because Brutus himself is a kind of a self-righteous, sort of stuck-up kind of character. But there's something about his integrity and about his family's history that causes other people to fall in with him. Cassius orchestrates the conspiracy pretty well. And if Brutus weren't such a dummy, they would have done the thing that would have enabled them to succeed, which is to kill Mark Antony. I mean, Cassius says, we cannot leave Mark Antony alive. You know, it's just too dangerous. And in retrospect, he's completely right. And Brutus, who thinks it's possible to, you know, to in a way, he's a little bit like Macbeth. He thinks, okay, we'll just do one murder. We won't even call it a murder. We say we're not going to, you know, it's not where we're going to kill him. We're going to carve him up like a sacrifice to the gods, which is self-delusion, and it's murder. And Cassius understands, now, if you kill Caesar, you got to kill Mark Antony too. So he's the political manager, I think, par excellence, but he's not the guy who's going to inspire people.
And you highlight a modern character who understood that exercising power often requires manipulation, Lyndon B. Johnson. How did he display Shakespearean manipulation to wield power?
Oh, well, I mean, I would refer everybody to the truly incredible Robert Caro biography of him, which I think is now 4 volumes, which gives it all in chapter and verse. And it involved outrageous flattery. It involved a certain degree even of physical intimidation. You know, Johnson used his body. He was a big guy. And there are these famous pictures where he's arguing with the publisher of the New York Times, I think, because he wants better publicity. And if you see the time sequence, he's leaning further and further over this poor publisher who's leaning further and further backwards to get away from him. You know, he used his techniques depending on who he was dealing with. He was a manipulator, but he was also a phenomenal listener. And that's actually how he learned what buttons to press with somebody. You know, what do they respond to? What do they need? What are they afraid of? And he would play to both people's strengths and their weaknesses, to their vanity, but also to the values that they had. You know, there's a great novel, one of the great American political novels, All the King's Men by Robert Penn Warren, I think has a picture of a very similar character who is a sort of loosely modeled on Huey Long, but who's also a fantastic manipulator of people. You have to have a certain kind of thoroughgoing understanding of the strengths and weaknesses of human nature and be willing to suppress your own ego enough to figure out what's going on with the other guy and then to work with it.
Yeah, it takes a certain instinct. I think part of it's innate and then you can develop it. But yeah, some people have it more than others for sure.
Yeah, and I think, by the way, I think the great authoritarians, and I mean great in the sense of successful, not great in any moral sense, usually have, if you look at it closely, an almost feral instinct for people's weaknesses, not for their strengths. They know how to appeal to the things that people are afraid of or intimidated by or worried about. And they can often just sense that in a way that it's, you know, it's almost like a kind of an animal sense.
Well, let's talk about how leaders can lose power. I mean, you talk about one of the ways that Shakespeare explores that leaders lose power is through just arrogance or being naive. Any plays or characters that stand out the most for that way?
Yeah, well, you know, actually in all of the plays I've talked about where somebody's deposed, whether it's Julius Caesar or Duncan or Richard II, they all have deep flaws that cause them to lose power. With Duncan, it's a kind of innocence, which might be charming if he weren't king, where he is just very, very naive about the people he's working with. With Richard II, it's his intoxication with his own position. With Julius Caesar, it's arrogance. It just is, you know, unbelievable arrogance. He comes in first, he's talking about himself in the third person, which is usually a sign that you got a problem. But then he says, I'm as constant as the Northern Star. I'm not like the rest of you who change. I am unchanging. And, you know, I am not afraid. Now, fear is afraid of me. I mean, it's over the top. And he pays for it. And I have to say, the more experience I have of life and of seeing political and military leaders in various settings, it's arrogance, I think, that does people in most.
How does that play out? Are they just, they're so high on their own supply that they're ignoring the things going on behind the scenes? Like, people starting to resent them, and those resentful people start thinking, let's get this guy out of here.
Yeah, they lose a sense of their own fallibility. They have excessive confidence in their ability to master any kind of difficult situation. They forget that you need allies and friends. They forget that they too can be surprised.
So leaders tend to, if they're not careful, they can start deceiving themselves and thinking they're
absolutely.
They're almost magical.
Yes. And I have a chapter, as you'll recall, about magic and self-deception. So one of the characters I talk about there is in Henry VI, Part 1. And I really encourage people to read the Henry VI plays. They're wonderful. I talk about Joan of Arc. She's shown as being very successful. But the thing that's so striking about it, if you look closely at her successes, Shakespeare gives you everything to understand that her successes are because she's smart, or because she persuades people this is the right thing to do, or she uses a certain kind of military ruse of one sort or another that brings her success. It's when she begins to believe in her own magic, you know, when she begins conjuring up spirits, that's the point where actually she fails and she ends up being burned at the stake. Nobody has real magical powers. And even in Shakespeare, you know, there are witches and ghosts and stuff like that. But if you look closely at how he describes them, all they're doing is they're playing to your weaknesses. They're playing to what you want to believe about yourself. So like Macbeth confronts the people say three witches. They're actually the three weird sisters, which is an interesting term. And all they do is they say things that are completely true, but are easy for Macbeth to interpret in such a way that it reinforces what he wants to believe. And, you know, they turn out to be wrong.
Are there any Shakespearean leaders who just walk away from power gracefully? Most of the ones we've been talking about, they were deposed. They had their power taken away from them against their will. Any ones who just said, I'm done. I'm passing the torch.
So the one who I think is most moving is Prospero in Tempest. So in Tempest, Prospero had been the Duke of Milan, but he's deposed by his brother because he's spent too much time in his library. He's a magician, and he has been marooned on this desert island with his daughter. And finally, his enemies all kind of are within his grasp, and he causes the storm. There's a shipwreck and various things, and there's sort of a reconciliation at the end. But Prospero, who has undoubted magical powers, he can call up storms and spirits and stuff like that. At the very end of the play, he says that I'm going to break my staff, my magic wand, and bury it several fathoms deep, and deeper than did plummet ever sound, drown my book, his book of magic spells. And it's interesting. Why is he going to do that? He's been restored as Duke of Milan. why should he give up his magical powers? And I think the answer that Shakespeare gives us is that Prospero has grown. And there's a hint that he already sort of has begun to understand this at the beginning. Very beginning of the play, he's going to explain to his daughter, how do we end up here? And he says, help me take off my magic robe, which means that he understands two things. One, if he's going to talk to his daughter as a father talks to a daughter rather than as a magician with superpowers talks to somebody he's responsible for, he's got to take off the magic robe. And he needs help, actually. He can't just take it off on his own. And I think that's what happens to him at the end. He understands power has not been good for him. And if you look at how he even treats Caliban, who's this sort of semi-human slave that he has, who at the beginning he's quite brutal towards. At the end, he said he acknowledges to the king, who's one of the people who's been shipwrecked. He says, this guy belongs to me, and I'm responsible for him. And he humanizes himself. And it's not that he's happy, because he says, I'm going to go back, and every third thought is going to be of death. But he has become a human figure, and he's a more likable, more reasonable kind of figure. And in the book, what I then do is I talk about other people who walk off the stage, of whom the most impressive is George Washington, who really does it twice. Once as commander-in-chief, makes a big point of handing his commission back to the Continental Congress, which he didn't have to do, and then when he steps down as president. And, George III, who didn't have any particular reason to love George Washington, said, if he does that, he'll be the greatest man of the age, which he was. And like Prospero, it's not that he was happy at the end of his presidency. It had been a really difficult time. But he did the right thing, and he left with a certain kind of contentment and wholeness, which can only happen, I think, if you voluntarily relinquish power.
Any advice you have for people about walking away from power, right? This could be, your executive position at a business or maybe a nonprofit, or you could be a dean at a university or whatever. Because you've seen this firsthand with really powerful people, and they're in that position where their power is waning, their influence is waning, and they're just really graspy. Like, they just want to hold on to it. It just seems like it's miserable. It seems kind of pitiful.
It often is quite pitiful.
So people who are successful at just kind of walking away with some dignity and the like, what do they do differently?
Well, it comes from the inside, obviously, and some ability to be introspective. I think for those people who are not towering figures, one thing that helps is if you have a very strong relationship with somebody who will be honest with you. And, Churchill had that with his wife, Clementine. People don't always have that person, but that's one thing. But the other thing is to remind yourself that you are not indispensable. Somebody once said, I think it was Charles de Gaulle, said the cemeteries are filled with indispensable men. And you got to keep on telling yourself that. The ancients, of course, were there before us in all this. Famously, when the great general had a triumph in Rome, they'd have a slave riding in the chariot with him, whispering, "Sic transit gloria mundi." This is the way that the glories of the world pass. So I think that is another part of it. But I think it's, maybe it just comes from understanding that this is part of your job too. Your job, whatever your job is, whatever your leadership job is, it has many components. It includes inspiring people. It may be building something. It may be eliminating something or destroying something. And ending it well is also part of your job. And if you can't find somebody else to tell you that, you need to tell yourself that.
Yeah. You need to read some Shakespeare.
Yeah. Well, yeah. It's always good to read Shakespeare.
Well, Elliot, this has been a great conversation. Where can people go to learn more about the book and your work?
Hopefully they'll want to buy the book, and it's for sale, on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and hopefully in any decent bookstore. For other things that I've written, again, what I would do is just look at some of my books. I'm retiring from Johns Hopkins University. I've moved over to the Center for Strategic and International Studies. But I think if people are particularly interested in this question of leadership, they may want to look at a book of mine called Supreme Command, Soldiers, Statesmen, and Leadership in Wartime. And it's built around a study of four great civilian wartime leaders: Abraham Lincoln during the Civil War, George Clemenceau, the Premier of France during World War I, Winston Churchill, obviously Britain in World War II, and David Ben-Gurion, the founding Prime Minister of Israel. And it asks, what is it that they did? What was the nature of the leadership that they exerted? And I think people might be interested in delving into that, because I do talk more about leadership there.
Fantastic. Well, Elliot Cohen, thanks for your time. It's been a pleasure.
Well, thank you. It's been a real pleasure for me too.
My guest today was Elliot Cohen. He's the author of the book, The Hollow Crown. It's available on Amazon.com and bookstores everywhere. Check out our show notes at aom.is/Shakespeare, where you can find links to resources where you can delve deeper into this topic. Well, that wraps up another edition of the AOM podcast. Make sure to check out our website at artofmanliness.com, where you can find our podcast archives. And while you're there, sign up for our newsletter. We get a daily option, a weekly option. They're both free. It's the best way to keep on top of what's going on at AOM. And if you haven't done so already, I'd appreciate it if you take 1 minute to give us a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. It helps out a lot. And if you've done that already, thank you. Please consider sharing the show with a friend or family member who you'd think we get something out of it. As always, thank you for the continued support. And until next time, this is Brett McKay, reminding you time to listen to AOM Podcast, but put what you've heard into action.
Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. In fact, Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/podcastfree. All lowercase, shopify.com/podcastfree, shopify.com/podcastfree.